Hi there, everybody. Welcome to The Principal Entrepreneur. I am your host and author of the upcoming book, How to Be a Great Principal, Jonathan Brooks. This is episode 84 of The Principal Entrepreneur, where we support educational leaders with strategies and suggestions that answer the question, how do I become a great principal? I also interview principals and school and educational leaders just like me and you and discuss their areas of expertise and how they overcome the challenges within schools. We're talking with professor, national presenter, former principal, and author, Dr. Capaluti. Dr. Capaluti is the author of literally dozens and dozens of scholarly articles. And the first book we're going to talk about today, The Savvy Principal, What Streetwise Principals Know. We'll dive into the inspiration for that particular book a bit later in the conversation. But before we do so, let's get into your origin story. Dr. Capaluti, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be part of it.
We were just talking a few minutes before, and you asked me how I found your book. I was Googling principals that are authors, and your book came up. So we'll get into that in a few minutes. But let's talk about how you got into education in the first place and kind of your origin story.
Sure. Well, I was thinking about reflecting on that question myself and wondering how I did become an education. I originally wanted to be a professional baseball player. And then I went to a tryout and realized that I wasn't going to be. So I was devastated. It took me a while to get over that. And I had a teacher and a coach in school, in fact, a junior high school, I really liked. So I said, well, this might be a good option for me. Since I'm not going to be a professional baseball player, I'll be a coach. So I started doing that. My high school counselors were no help at all and helped me figure out what to do. In fact, when I was in school, they used to guidance counselors interest inventories with us.
Right.
He came back and said, Jody, your two options are, one, be a member of the clergy, or a mortician.
Or a mortician?
A mortician. Now, I sort of looked surprised, realizing those weren't options for me. I think he realized after he completed my inventory that those weren't options for me either. So I ended up going to college. It was during the Vietnam War. And studying, and I became a teacher. And then after a few years of teaching, I was asking all these questions, why are we doing it this way? And nobody seemed to have a good answer on why we were. So then I was offered an opportunity to go to grad school at Virginia Tech, and I just quit everything, packed up, and headed to Virginia Tech. So that's how I got to that point.
So you went from...
I'm from Maine.
From coaching to teaching, was there a specific person who said maybe you should go into teaching, or what was that transition from the coaching piece to deciding, okay, I'm going to be a teacher?
Nobody really did. I didn't have that much guidance, and that's one of the things that always concerns me now in schools is I don't think we do enough career explanation or awareness for kids. They either go into the profession their family did. None of my parents went to college, so I didn't have those sort of role models. As I look back, I'm really not sure how I ended up in that path. It has been a great one for me. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's provided me an opportunity to meet many wonderful people and hopefully impact a lot of kids and teachers. But I really didn't have a clear path that I wasn't a kid that, when I was younger, said I'm going to be a teacher. I thought I was going to be a principal when I was in high school, and I don't think anybody aspires to do that.
Exactly.
I don't think it would register on any scale. It just sort of worked out well. I think when I was invited to be a graduate student and offered a scholarship and stipends, that's when I realized that somebody thought I could do something and make an impact. That's my story, and it turned out to be good for me. I clearly had no great guidance to get there.
So you went to Virginia Tech, you got your doctorate,
right?
And then you got your job as a principal. What was one of the biggest challenges that you had in that role?
Well, there were several. One, that I was always younger than everybody that I worked with, because I didn't take the traditional path of teaching like 30 or 40 years and becoming an administrator. So
right. The
first one was that I was younger and had to establish credibility. I think the second thing was that everybody mattered. I was really, from my graduate school work, I worked with Lloyd Trump and Don Sharps, and they were involved with differentiated staffing, which was a way to utilize people differently in schools. And from that, I was into collaborative decision-making. At the time, in the 70s, nobody was. So to get teachers to believe that they would have a voice that mattered was a struggle at first, because they would always say, well, what should we do? Because
right.
I think they used to be told what to do.
I don't think much has changed.
Yeah, probably not. In some places it has, and in some places it has. So my biggest struggle, I think, was a young administrator to say, let's do this, we can do this together, without them thinking I didn't know what I was doing, that I just was passing off work to them.
Right, right.
That usually just took a few months. And then they realized this guy was serious, that he did listen to us, and that we can make a difference, and that I always believed that change could happen really quickly, that it didn't need to take years and years to do it. And so in the two places I was a principal, we really changed things very quickly. If we had the good rationale and good data, we just made things happen. So I think the biggest challenges were I was young. Nobody did collaborative decision-making when I began to do it, and that if you had decent data, you could change things quickly. You could change them in the middle of the year. Why wait till the end?
So people
got on board with that idea. My philosophy was and always is, in the schools, nobody's more important than anybody else. We just have different jobs to do.
Right.
So we had custodians being assistant coaches on teams. We had secretaries running activity clubs. We had all different arrangements, which really gave people value.
Right, right. That's one of the things that I've been asking myself is, because you and I have a similar philosophy. I call it shared leadership. You call it collaborative.
Yeah.
Coming in and asking that question, or delegating or sharing that power, I often ask myself, does it look like I don't know what I'm doing because I'm giving people the power to make choices?
Yeah.
And then sometimes from the staff perspective, they want a more authoritarian role, and they want me to just
right.
tell them what to do. And
right.
then they're kind of in that position of dad doesn't have any power or know what he's doing. So.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I agree with you on that one. I think what happens is you always have to establish your credibility. You have no chips when you take a new job. Nobody ever asked to read my dissertation.
Right.
So anything that I'd done before that didn't matter. It's just what I did from the day I started. I think one of the things that the new principals have overcome now is a confidence factor. Unless you're confident in what you're doing, you don't dare delegate. Because if you get that one person back that says, well, that's your job, you don't know how to handle that.
Right.
And I've just found your best employees want a say in significant decisions, not, you know, what's for lunch on the workshop, PD day. But they really want, your best staff members want significant involvement in decisions that impact them, which is even harder nowadays with all the mandates that come down. The principal really has to filter out, you know, what's real and what isn't real, what's enforceable, what isn't enforceable. But I still think the best model is, you know, if you work together, there are a lot more bright people in the building than just one person.
Absolutely.
And a smart principal realizes that. But I think that also comes a little bit, I didn't know any better, I think, at the time. So I was probably a little brash when I started, because I thought it would work, but I didn't know it wouldn't work.
Right, right. So how did you overcome that lack of credibility and those types of things?
We got fast results. I mean, we went to the board, we'd get significant increase in funding. At the last position I held, within 3 years, we were a model school nationally. We just changed our practices dramatically. Test scores went up, attendance went up, teacher attendance went way up. They just saw results. We kept data on everything. And the more you see results, the more recognition teachers get, which I think is always important.
Right.
The more they say, we must be doing something right. And to me, the whole key was having data to support anything you're doing, either the sense of need, the urgency for doing it. Charisma only takes you about 5 minutes. Unless you can explain to somebody why, what need we're meeting doing this, nobody's gonna do it anymore because they've seen too many things come and go.
Right, right.
You have to do it because it makes sense. I mean, how many mandates have we seen that there's no teeth in? Right? I mean.
Right, every day.
A ton of them. So right. Teachers are genuinely weary of that, and they're skeptical, which they should be. I think the other thing that was a challenge for me is convincing the central office that every school didn't need to look alike.
Right.
That you never have to have every program at every school. I think because of my background in differentiated staffing, I don't know if you're familiar with that concept, but one of the things that struck me of that was the initial thinking in education is schools are organized around the concept that a teacher is a teacher is a teacher. That if you've taught for 30 years and you're an okay teacher, if you've taught for 10 years and you're just a lights-out, tremendous, high-powered teacher, and if you've taught 0 years, the school all gives you the same amount of students.
Right.
They don't differentiate who you get, what you do. So that really struck with me, that maybe there's a different way to use staff and use the resources that you have. Maybe the person who's taught for 10 years, maybe they teach 4/5 times and they mentor other people the other part of the time. So that allowed me to really think about how to use resources in schools differently. And that would cause some, at times, skepticism or irritation or wonderment from other principals saying, if he has like 8 special ed staff, why is one not teaching?
Right.
And I would just say, well, I have no more staff than anybody else, and I'm just using one as a coordinator or facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
And kids coming in and out. And so I think there's always a challenge when you do something different. Superintendents feel the pressure. Why is this school doing that and not another one? I think if you're doing something right and the staff see it, they will support you. And if staff support you, it always works.
Right, right.
Quite a long answer to your question. But
you got to it.
So, I got to it, yeah, I got to it.
So we mentioned that you were a professor of aspiring principals. What's the single greatest takeaway from your experience as a principal that you would like to pass on to aspiring principals or principals like me who are just in their first couple years?
I would say, and one reason I wrote the book was to put in some things that would sort of help people find the right job initially. One is the job has to match your values. You can't work for a community that has different values than you do. For example, if you believe in equity and all kids should be provided access to all the curriculum, then you wouldn't work in a school system that highly tracks beginning in the third grade. So, and if you don't find that match, it's horrendous.
Right.
You won't succeed because then you're arguing what to do, not discussing how to do it. So the first issue for me always is telling students, do your homework, figure out what things really matter to you. What are the things that you won't compromise on? And then find a district who has similar values to yours, whether it's a very affluent suburb, whether it's a rural poor, whether it's inner city, whether it's a farming community, whether it's whatever the community is. Communities get what they want. They're not going to change based on what you want.
Right, right.
And I know some communities that don't want to do anything different than they did 50 years ago because they have a 98.5 rate of kids going to college. So if you want to change some things, you certainly don't want to work there. But the first thing is a match with your values. The second thing is, which people seem to find interesting, is I would not work for a superintendent who's way out of shape or has no out-of-school activities. Because if they don't take care of themselves, they're not going to take care of you. They're going to expect you to work 24/7. One of the issues that I've been researching lately with a colleague of mine is, and I think I shared with you a couple of those articles, the impact of social media on principals' lives. How much time is the principal expected to be available, either through email, text, blogs, web pages, Twitter accounts, to their constituencies?
24/7.
It's killing principals. Because once you respond on a Saturday morning at 9 o'clock,
yep.
Mrs. Jones, who has a quick question, that Mrs. Jones expects you to be available every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock.
Yep.
One of the things we found out is, in the research we've been doing, is that school systems pretty much don't want to set policies. Most systems, the way I think our policies is respond within 24 hours. And I will say, is that 24 clock hours or 24 work hours?
Right.
24 work hours may be 3 days.
Right, right.
So I'm very concerned because I've talked to principals with focus groups that the lack of definition is killing the balance between home and family. You know, if you're sitting at home on a Sunday morning doing email, something's wrong. Because if you say yes to that, you say no to something else, which is usually your family or your
yep.
or how you spend your personal time.
Yep.
You can't work 24/7. And to me, one of the biggest changes in education is the instant expectation. I certainly use technology. I'm not opposed to it, but you have to have a balance.
So how do you recommend setting those boundaries?
I recommend first they ask the superintendent what to set a policy. You know, when are we supposed to be available? And have the school board address it. They don't want to do that. Because then it becomes an issue with teachers also. Do you pay them? Right?
Right.
If my contract says I work 7.5, 8 hours a day as a teacher, if you expect me to work beyond those hours, then you're going to have to pay me.
They don't like doing that.
Well, nobody wants to deal with it because they want everybody to be responsive, but they don't want to deal with the reality of when are you not working? When are you off the clock? And to me, from talking to principals at all levels, that's the most significant issue they're facing now. What you sometimes have in districts is principals who want to be tech superstars. They are available. They're blogging. They have Twitter accounts. They're every 5 minutes, every thought they have, they're posting because they want to be seen as a tech guru. And you have other administrators who say, well, wait a minute, I need some space. When I go home at night, I need to go home.
Right.
So this tension caused between administrators. I think it's the single biggest challenge our profession faces right now is when are you working and when are you not on the clock?
Yeah, just with the number of emails that you can get, if you're doing your job as an instructional leader, you're not answering those emails during the day.
Yeah.
So then, you know, depending on how many are rolling in, you might stay another extra hour from work, but that doesn't mean you're going to hit all those emails.
Right.
And if you're trying to clean out your inbox, you're at home after dinner or as dinner's getting prepped, trying to go through those emails. So it's really difficult, especially for larger schools with a greater number of students and parents that are, you know, trying to get in contact with you to respond, especially since they think that they're the only one sending that email, or they at least act in that manner.
That's right. But my suggestion to principals would be have the emails go to your secretary and have her screen them. Remember the old days we used to get mail?
Yep.
and the secretary, administrative assistant, would open the mail?
Yeah.
I think you get a lot less emails if you send them through somebody else.
That's a good idea.
And you wouldn't get, you know, the stupid questions or the long. I'm working with a principal now who has a binder 4 inches thick of emails from one parent. That's ridiculous.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, I just see it as an intrusion on people's being able to balance home and work. And unless you can separate those two, you, at some point, somebody who cares about you is going to say, when are you not working, Dad? When are you not working, Mom?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you play with me? Can we take a walk? Can we go for a walk? And you go to the playground, see all the people on cell phones who aren't watching their kids. You have to have a time where you're not doing anything. And I'm just as guilty as anybody else.
Yeah.
When my cell phone's with me. When I go biking, I put it on my bike. But I think, and when work comes, it's either Germany or England that has a not law now. You can't forget which country it is. But unless you have some sort of separation, at some point you just become fried. you become resentful.
Yeah. So how did these experiences, and these conversations with other principals tie into your book, The Savvy Principal?
Well, I've been teaching for a number of years and working for a number of years with principals and being a principal myself. I'd use a lot of the examples that I came up with in class. And students would say, why don't you write about that? One of the ones I write about is, if you allow it, you approve it. Was one of the things I always talk about. So I said, okay, well, I'll think about doing a book. And then I said, well, this will be a good way for students to see how somebody writes a book. So I found a publisher, Roman and Littlefield, which took some convincing because if you work at a university, you're not supposed to write a book without research in it.
Right.
That's frowned upon. But I'm at the point in my career where I could get away with that. And I had enough credibility with the publisher. They said, okay, Jody, we'll give it a try. They approved the proposal. So I started to write the book. And I said to the students, I'm going to show you every draft of a chapter I have. And I'm going to give you, whoever wants, an opportunity to edit it with me. So you can see how a book is written.
So by students, you mean...
Students in my graduate class.
Okay.
I have a contract to write a book. This is what a contract looks like. I'm going to write a book. This is the outline of my chapters. And as I draft something, I have ideas. If you want to participate with me, I will send you everything that I'm writing. And I had about a half a dozen that said they'd like to do that on a regular basis, maybe seven or eight. And then I started to post. I had a blog. I started to post on the blog what I was writing to get feedback. And then the publisher said I couldn't do that because I was giving away free material. So I stopped the blog, but I kept it with the students. So we went through the whole process of how you write a book and how difficult it really is, you know, how you design a cover, how you go through all these different parts. And so I basically used all stories that I had experienced either as a principal, as a consultant to schools, or in, you know, my working with interns. We do a year-long internship. And I'd always... The book was written in a way you could read any chapter any way you wanted to read it. Because I didn't want to write a book that was 500 pages long, as you know, many texts are. And the only informative part of the chapter is the first paragraph and the last paragraph. You read all this other stuff to get to the key point.
Right.
I wanted to get right to the bullets of people, whether they're experienced or not. For example, if you allow it, you approve it. I try to use concrete examples, for example... If you have high school superlatives or middle school superlatives, do you have best smile in your yearbook or a class couple? And I would say, okay, what if a student comes to you and says, Mr. So-and-so, I'd really like to be a class couple. My parents were best couple. What's the rubric for best couple?
Right.
What do you say? Or best smile. Is it really important to you as a principal that all kids have good teeth? I said, what if somebody's poor? We were fortunate. My daughter had great teeth. My son didn't. It cost us like $8,000 to get his teeth pulled out and straightened. But if you don't have the funds, you don't have that.
Right.
So it's really saying to the kids, I value good teeth. I value dress. I value you guys partnering off as couples. Is that really what you want?
Mm-hmm.
Because they think it's kind of ridiculous at first. And I say, but that's really that you're expressing, you've allowed it, you approve it. And then we'll go to things such as, you know, tracking or class ranking.
Cell phones.
So I make the point that way. And I've had a great response. You know, people just said, I never thought of how your office is set up, what image that presents of you.
Mm-hmm.
Or how to deal with difficult, how do you deal with really tough issues with staff? And I provide some rubrics and outlines, direct questions from that. You just ask these questions to try to go through a process of figuring out what the issue is. So I basically just took stuff I'd done over the years and still continue to do and said, does it make sense to somebody? Can I find the literature that supports it? No, I probably can't, but some of the literature doesn't make any sense anyway.
Right.
So I said, does this make sense to principals or aspiring principals? And it really has. I've been just very overwhelmed by the response. People will say, you know, why didn't I just read this before I started being a principal?
Yeah.
I didn't realize how my office was set up, what I even had on the walls. When somebody comes in, says what I value. Do I have 15 awards of myself up there? You know, do I have all the degrees I have, every track award I've won, every soccer award I've won? Is it about me?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there a, or is my office disheveled? I look totally unorganized. Boxes aren't unpacked. Like you go into anybody's office, what image you're trying to present, like going into a store. You know, what's the store trying to, the image are they trying to set up of the store?
Yeah, you got me looking around my office and feeling bad.
Yeah, I mean, if I walked in and sat down, if I was searching for a school and I was a parent and I walked in your office, what would I think you valued?
Not organization.
So that would say something to me, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So I probably wouldn't go to somebody if I was looking for an organization development specialist. I'd come to you with your office. I may be totally wrong, but it's the image is sent, right?
Right.
Even the colors that are in there, where your desk is set up. Is there a table to sit at where you can collaborate?
Mm-hmm.
All these sorts of things, and you know, people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with environmental psychologists and architects to set up spaces to create images. And when you walk into the school, in most schools now, you can't find the front door.
Mm-hmm.
Because I visit a lot of schools. Sometimes you just can't, even because of security, you cannot find the front door.
Right.
The parking lots are half a mile away. There are no arrows. How customer friendly are you? When you call to the school, do you get a recording? You know, we're not able to take your phone call. Press 1 for the kitchen, 2 for the principal 7. Mm. So it's just some of those things that I wrote about.
Yeah, just little things that you're right, that you don't necessarily think about unless you got a bird's eye view.
Yeah. You don't think about it. So it was really fun to write. That's how it came about, really from students saying, and other people, they used to call them Jodyisms, and they'd write them down, and then I'd hear it later on. I still hear it when I'm in schools, which is nice, but really, they're my ideas and ideas I've seen from successful principals.
Right.
I was at a conference many years ago where every year principals get together and university people, and they talk about how to make the principalship better. And this one principal who was retiring from a high school position at the end of the third day, he was really dedicated to his job, worked, you know, really well-respected in the area and the state. He said, I finally realized with just a few months left in my job that I raised everybody else's kids but my own, which really struck me about balancing home and work. The school will still be there when you leave it. Somebody else will come in and take your place. You work as hard as you can when you're there and do the best as you can when you're there, but you're not indispensable.
Right.
And you know, your desk is never cleared.
Yeah. So if you were to give... to give that piece of advice to a principal that's just starting out, is that kind of where you're going?
Yeah, I think that what I want people to do is to pick the right position and have the skills to stay at it and not have such a horrendous experience the first year they say, I'm going back to teaching. But I think principals are the key for kids in schools and teachers in schools being successful. We don't have enough great principals. We need more, and we need to do as much as we can to encourage them to stay in that role. And I think the more things you learn to make your job more meaningful and easier, the more satisfaction you will get from it.
Yeah. So I've enjoyed our time. Great conversation, great advice. Last question for me. What are two books that have had a great impact on your philosophy or on your way of thinking or, you know, just on your practice?
Yeah. It hasn't been so much books, but it was the thinking when I was back in grad school, the work of Lloyd Trump, Don Sharps, Dwight Allen, when they really looked at how schools are organized, the collaborative decision-making, the alternative structures. It was really the concept of a teacher is a teacher is a teacher. It was that sort of thinking, I think, that really changed my total outlook on how schools could be organized. And then I think later on, when I was doing a lot of curriculum integration work, it was the work of James Bean, who who really helped me, you know, schools are democratic societies and the generalized curriculum, and that everybody really should have access to the whole curriculum, and that curriculum should be a problem-solving approach, you know, trying to solve real-life issues, and the curriculum should be organized around that. I would say James Bean's work was very influential in my, when I was a principal and worked with curriculum. So I guess it was initially a group of thinkers, not so much one writing, and then James Bean's influential work on curriculum integration really influenced my work as a middle school principal and my writing as well. His stuff is still applicable today. You know, is what you're learning relevant the time you're learning it, and does it deal with a real-world issue?
Right.
No, it's pretty much irrelevant. You know, why am I learning this? And the application of it.
That is a lot to wrap your head around. I'm going to go back and listen to this and take some notes. Really appreciate your time. If people want to reach out to you and find out more about you and about your books, where can they find you at?
Well, they can find my book on Amazon.com, or they can send me an email at joseph.capelluti, C-A-P-E-L-L-U-T-I, @maine.edu. And I'll be glad to correspond with anybody. I always enjoy engaging in this conversation. Principals need as much support and help as they can. It's the most important job in schools, which is supporting teachers, so we can work to make sure every kid gets a great education, not just a few. So I enjoyed the conversation very much.
All right, I appreciate you. You have a good day.
You as well.
Once again, that was principal, speaker, professor, and author of The Savvy Principal, What Streetwise Principals Know, Dr. Jody Capelluti. Three main pieces of advice that he dispensed were: make sure that you establish credibility, everyone matters, engage in collaborative decision-making, and find a district that matches your value. He also gave some insight into the rapidly changing a school, which included make sure that you have a good rationale for the changes that you're making and have the data to support that rationale. He also talked about his book and how he went about writing that, as well as numerous tips to think about as you organize and structure your school. A couple tweetable quotes: in a school, nobody is more important than anybody else. We just have different jobs. New principals have to overcome the confidence factor. A principal has to filter out what's real and what isn't real, what's enforceable and what isn't enforceable. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Jody Capelluti. If you're a principal, make sure that you check out the new grant scholarships that are available that honor the hard work that you put in on a daily basis. K-12 principals, you can click on the grant application at my website, howtobeagreatprincipal.com. For more short articles and tips that support educational leaders, you can go over to that website. Again, that is howtobeagreatprincipal.com. While you're there, you can pre-order my upcoming book, How to Be a Great Principal, 36 Shared Leadership Strategies. If you are an auditory learner, you are in the exact right spot, and you can download other episodes of this podcast, The Principal Entrepreneur, where we have new episodes weekly, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and if we're lucky enough to have an interview like this one, those usually come up on Saturdays. To join the podcast as a guest, email me at jonathanroyce@theprincipalentrepreneur.com. Finally, I'm part of a community of supportive principals. Please join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook, type in The Principal Entrepreneur, and our private Facebook group will pop up, and I will be happy to give you access. That is it for today. Thanks for listening to The Principal Entrepreneur.